Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Happy holidays, and what is good, internet? It is me, Austin Walker, on another day of our holiday podcasts. Joining me today is a slightly cut down group. It's just me, it's just Patrick, it's just Rob.
Austin, we're saying Merry Christmas now.
No. I'm saying Happy Holidays.
We're saying Merry Christmas now.
Hanukkah's over, but you're
Merry Christmas is back. Christmas is back. It went away, but now it's back.
Where'd it go? Who got rid of it?
What was
Obama doing with all those Christmas wishes?
Ask Harry Reid. It's with the alloys.
Oh, it's with the alien alloys. Do you think by the time this podcast comes out, we'll know what's up with those alien alloys?
Do you watch that video?
I watched the video.
It's really weird.
It's really weird. I fucking love that article so much. I know we already talked about it on a different podcast.
On a different day? I don't know where that date might not have happened yet.
I don't even know. Alien alloys.
I'm sweating about those alien alloys.
What I want you to sweat about instead, though, is the future, Patrick.
That's easy.
It sure is. So today on the site, you wrote a piece about loot boxes. One of this year's major themes, one of the major trends in gaming in 2017. What do you think about loot boxes?
Well, it was interesting because as part of sort of trying to think about loot boxes a little more like holistically, I thought it'd be interesting to go back and read how people were talking about sort of like the advent of microtransactions, which
right,
I think like the most
right.
contemporary example, like sort of when it entered the mainstream. In a way that we were thinking about, like, oh, this is going to change everything, was like when the Xbox 360 launched and Elder Scrolls 4 Oblivion was released, and they, you know, infamously, like one of the first pieces of DLC they put out was for horse armor, like a cosmetic edition that I believe was $1.50 or $2 or something like that. And I mean, people just like collectively like lost their shit about buying a completely optional cosmetic option for a game that, you know, there are a lot of things you can say about, you know, Oblivion or Skyrim, but like saying like they weren't like content rich or like feature complete,
right,
like it's
right.
not one of those. Like they, it is not a game that you play and go, aha, I see where they're about to nickel and dime me on, along the edges. Like, and so it was interesting to, one, I've been doing this long enough, and I was like, I wonder what people were saying about that when that happened. And then I Googled
right.
it, and I was able to – one of the articles that came up was an article I wrote in 2006.
Hell yeah.
So I was like, all right.
Where were you? Was that
– I was in college writing for 1UP. I graduated in 2006, I believe. So maybe I was at 1UP at that point. I can't quite remember the exact moment. I have to go look at the timestamp on
the
that
date. Yeah, but
I was able to. I was like, I can now start using my own material as like reference material in stories that I'm writing more than 10 years later. It was interesting. So one of the quotes that I had plucked from like a 1UP reader was in response to the horse armor was they wrote 1UP user Ryan Kaplan, aka Tylahedrus, wrote.
Thank you for the credit.
You're still out there, Ryan. I hope things are well for you. I'm going to pay a premium for a nifty hat. I don't like the idea that if I want to color Master Chief White in Halo 3 multiplayer, I'll need to shell out even more cash. Doesn't anyone else see that this micropayment crap will lead to incomplete games? Which I thought was like an interestingly prophetic statement for like where a lot of this would go over the next 10 years. It was also interesting to see how Bethesda in a 2015 like GDC talk, like looking back on Oblivion, like they discussed like what the whole horse armor controversy, and one of the level designers, this guy named Joel Burgess, wrote or said back in 2005, developers were wondering, was what does DLC even mean? How do we make it? How do we expect to know what people even want to play or what it's going to cost? We didn't know what we should charge. And so, like, you know, the tact that this designer was saying was that they kind of were just throwing shit at the wall to see it would stick, which is probably true, and someone had to start doing that. But it's interesting, like, if we go from horse armor to loot boxes, I think most people right now would say, bring back the horse armor. And instead what we got was, like, we now have gotten loot, like horse armor in loot boxes is essentially right. Like where things like Overwatch have gone,
which
is like
Overwatch and Destiny and so many other like customization, visual customization type stuff that you don't even get right out of. You don't get to go to a store and say, "Oh, I want the gold horse armor."
Right.
You get a box, and maybe you don't even get a box. What you get is you decide, do you want a gray box, a blue box, or a gold box? And you know, maybe if you get a gold box, you're guaranteed to get a really pretty horse armor, but not even the horse armor you necessarily want. And that is like the loot box situation in a lot of games and a lot of big games that would be would take up the same amount of time in your gaming schedule as games like Skyrim did, but now are multiplayer, allowing you to show off this fancy new skin that you got from your blue box that you saved up for and you spent, or you didn't save up for, and you decided, I'm just going to spend this $12 to get 5 blue boxes right now today. And that's happening.
That's the kind of skin job I'd love to retire.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for bringing your Ready Player One references here. That's...
Oh, okay. Wow. I guess I'm going to leave the podcast now.
Oh, fuck. Fuck me.
Get that weak-ass 80s shit off Austin's
get
fucking
the fuck
podcast.
Out of here. Was that Blade Runner? I didn't see any blades get run. Shit.
Are all 80s references now just forever tainted by Ernest Cline?
Ernest Cline, you ruined it for everybody.
The 80s no longer count. We're moving on to 90s references.
Hell yeah, baby. It was a good joke, Rob. Thank you. Thank you for doing that.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I mean, what's and you know, so also part of what I wrote about was sort of like the continuum or the escalation of irritation in 2017, in which, you know, you've had folks like a credit to, you know, Jim Sterling, who used to be a writer and critic over at Destructoid, and now like mostly publishes on YouTube, although he does do some writing at a website that he runs for his own stuff as well. Like, he has been sort of like banging the drum about loot boxes and the idea that they are exploitative of people for, at this point, probably years would be an accurate summation. And there are folks that... who I think there is legitimate credence to this belief that loot boxes are inherently manipulative and exploitative and bad, and that even in a game like Overwatch, which I think for a lot of people, the thought is, well, that doesn't materially impact what it is to play the game. I pay 30 or 40 bucks or whatever for the game, and that, yes, there are loot boxes, and yes, you know, you could see a world where people are exploited out of that if they can't control themselves. But for like the vast majority of the people playing that game, if they want to engage with that, they can, but it doesn't change when you pull the trigger. Like, it is still a skill-based game, like at its core. And what irritated people about Battlefront 2, which came on an escalation of Middle-Earth, Shadow of War, and Forza Motorsport 7, which were both games that included loot boxes to varying degrees. Like, Shadow of War, you didn't need to engage with it, but it seemed like if you wanted to reasonably get through the end games, like, or the post-game stuff in a way that didn't take you a bajillion years, like, you might want to have to engage with that. Forza was just, like, confusing across the board, so they're just two games that was, like, sloppy execution of the concept of loot boxes. And the Battlefront 2 did, which was meaningfully and materially different than what any other game of that scale had done prior to it, was mingling that with the game design, which is to say that the way that Battlefront 2 works is that when you equip cards to your character, and these cards imbue you with different powers. Sometimes that means you throw like a thermal grenade instead of a whatever. And then it also has a material impact, or can have a material impact, on things like health regeneration, like, you know, like how much damage you're outputting. And what that does is that it means, like, it is not purely skill-based or like a rock, paper, scissors scenario in terms of like when two players encounter each other. It could be the case that someone shoots someone another player in the head at the exact same time. One goes down because the other person got the right dice roll from a loot box. And right. because those loot boxes are things that can both be earned through in-game credits, although at a slower rate than people were happy with, and they ended up altering like the drop rate so that people could get that faster, it also meant you could buy it. And so it intermingled with the design and created an air of suspicion, an air of, like, how can I trust anything that they're doing in this game in a way that I, you know, resulted in the complete shitstorm that we saw, you know, going forward.
And that loss of trust, I think, was pretty key. And the sort of realization, for me, this kind of hits into this larger thing that happened throughout the year in games. Not the larger thing, but not a larger thing at all. But there was a through line of this sort of thing. One of my favorite things that happened this fall was the thread of ways in which game designers tricked players. The sort of thing of like, oh, did you know that the first few shots that a splicer throws at you or shoots at you in BioShock are programmed to miss but get your attention? I love it so much. And so part of the response to that was like, it's like, fuck you. No, it's a fair fight. And not the whole response. I don't even think that the majority of the response was that, but you could find a line of response that was like, I want a fair fucking game. I want to know that I killed that splicer. I killed that boss. I killed that. I won the race. There was no rubber banding. The designers didn't make it in my favor or make it extra hard against me. And I don't think those are the same type of thing, but this notion of like, the desire for all gameplay to be perfectly equitable and the focus on like the design shouldn't be influenced that way is something that that is like so loud and clear, is something that this audience gets invested in. It also happened in Destiny when they figured out via some very clever math that in Destiny 2, after you hit the max level, you continue to increase your level count, but you keep gaining XP. And when you level up, you get an extra loot box, basically. You can go cash in a loot box to get an aesthetic customization thing, like some skins or a different way for your gun to look, or a mod that can make you play a little bit better, actually. And what they figured out was certain activities were reporting, let's just say XP 10, but actually we're only giving like 5 XP or something. And that was said that was really repeatable, that you could easily grind out, and you were actually getting less than what it was reporting. And so like, I think it's been really interesting to see this as a place where, again and again, this community has this desire, sometimes for almost all, often for better, I think, sometimes for worse, that like, no, we need a fair playing field. And I'm curious how to motivate that desire towards making the world of gaming a little bit more equitable in general, and like how to actually find a new platform. Because I think the notion of people getting really angry about loot boxes can be easy to laugh at when you don't have an addictive personality, when you don't have a gambling addiction specifically, or when you haven't spent a lot of money on this, when in general it's easy for you to, or if you have enough money to just be like, yeah, fuck it, I'll buy a box every now and then.
Right.
This is a fun little extra thing. It's so easy to frame that as a non-problem, especially like if you're us and you get a lot of games for review sent to you. It's like, oh, well, I didn't spend $60 on this. I'll toss them $20 for crates and shit because I enjoyed this game. Like, it's so easy to convince yourself of that and to not think about it either as a problem or to even think about it in a meaningful, analytical way and think about what can you do with that passion and energy of people caring. And for me, the thing that I'm really interested in is, and you wrote a piece about this earlier this year, Patrick, in which you said, well, what is the alternative to loot boxes? Is it, an increased pay? You know, is it spending $70 on a game instead of $60? Like, if these companies want that money and are demanding, need to get that money, they need to get that budget paid for or whatever, what's that look like? And I want to just get, a whiteboard in front of us right now. Let's reimagine the games industry without loot boxes. What are our options? What are the things that you want to bring to the table as potential ways of doing that?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Not just you, Patrick. Rob, too, all of us.
Huh. I don't know. Rob, is there anything that comes to mind for you?
I mean, I look at that whiteboard,
uh-huh,
and all I see are, yep, complications and the limits of my own understanding. Like, and I mean, like, what I mean is, I do not have a good enough grasp of the economics of video games itself. Like, for instance, if you work in a large company, you sort of have to fight for budget year after year. Like, this is a feature of any large company, and so it's very easy to get in the mindset of thinking, well, look, resources are tighter than you think. There's only so much money to go around. But what you never see is the money that never hits your budget and goes elsewhere in the company to other priorities or other stakeholders. And so to an extent, like, yes, loot boxes are meant to support and make more economically viable the creation of these large platform-style games, these large AAA games. But at the same time, like, is that money actually paying people's salary? Or is, like, every dollar on loot boxes, 70 cents of that is going to Electronic Arts shareholders? And you know what I mean? It's like, I do not know the degree to which loot boxes are making the industry sustainable for making the kinds of games that I like,
right,
versus the degree to which loot boxes are managing to keep capital invested in bankrolling games that I like. And those are two different things.
How do you get to the point where you get to that information so that you can actually make that more accurate judgment? Is that just about trying to push companies to become more transparent, which I know seems impossible, but, you know, as Ursula K. Le Guin said, you know, so did the divine right of kings.
Yeah. I think the question is there's already a surprising amount of transparency with publicly traded companies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's already a lot of accounting information that you can glean. I think it's, and this is what I mean about, like, lack of seeing that whole picture. Like, that stuff I would have to dig into. But I think the bigger issue, I suppose, is, okay, so years and years ago, in the One Up Yours days,
yeah.
There's a phrase that got batted around a lot, which was, you know, hey, blank loves to make money or something
right.
And you still hear people trot versions of this out. It's like the sort of faux worldly way to explain why something fucking sucks. It's because, like, hey, man, this is capitalism and this is a business. It ain't a charity. And I feel like loot boxes sort of fit into that, where it's kind of this sort of hand wavy, like, look, man. This is how they make
the cost
money
of doing business. Yeah.
But we never ask, like, who the fuck is they?
Right.
Like, whose salaries are being paid, you know, being paid by loot boxes? Like, what projects were actually literally not profitable without loot boxes? I don't know those questions. And the other part of this, is that games have been surprisingly inflation resistant. This is true. But at the same time, like, skilled laborers in the game industry are often undercompensated.
Often very easily replaceable. Game development often has this period of scaling up in its kind of big push towards the middle and the final two chapters of development, kind of the final two acts of game development, and then often will lead to mass layoffs after a major project finishes, or at the very least moving those people, you know, onto different projects, you know, even in places where you end up keeping your job. You don't always stay on a project that you actually want to be on, which was, you know, again, that feels like the responsibility. It's the cost of doing business, you know.
Actually, so that's an important point too. I suppose, like, loot boxes are meant to sort of be a way to sort of smooth out what's otherwise a pretty spiky curve on you know, investment and return, and maybe make it a little more predictable as to what revenue a project is going to bring in. But the other aspect of this is a lot of studios, a lot of developers do have that routine of staff up in the final sprint and then fire everybody after it ships.
Right.
And that is probably accepted too much as the cost of doing business, but also, you know, a number of years ago, there was kind of an odd little story that Jason Schreier, I think it was, wrote on Kotaku about the, what is it, the video game Limbo that Ubisoft was running
Yeah, in Montreal. They have essentially like a studio that is just meant to keep you employed in between projects till you get reassigned to something else.
And it was just, and I'm not sure that Jason meant to imply this, but the way it was, I think, framed and the way a lot of people reacted to it is it was this like sad story of like, you know, oh man, this is like the game developer Island of Misfit Toys. When actually it was, if you've worked any kind of job, you know, there's moments where there's like literally nothing to do. Now, the employer still needs you. It might be a few hours, it might be a week, whatever. They still need your services. And Ubisoft, like, kind of to their credit, maintain a system where like those people are kept on payroll and kept employed and shuffled from priority to priority, which is far better than the we'll make everyone a contractor, fire their ass when the thing ships, and then hire them back in 6 months when we need them again.
Right.
And I think that's the other weird thing of like maybe over identification with the interests of shareholders and businesses as opposed to people. We tend to reflexively like look at a story like that. Oh man, all these people are sort of shuffled into this between projects like limbo state where they're not being productive employees for, you know, a month or two. That's fucked up, man. And it's like, no. That's called security. A break.
Yeah. Right, which is there are other industries in which we recognize that as part of what the industry is, right? Like we I don't think anyone thinks that all-star quarterbacks should not get a break, should not have an off season.
I mean, have you met NFL fans?
You're right. I thought about the NFL fans for a few seconds.
And also the NFL itself has talked about like expanding like the amount of games per year without actually like modifying like the players' union contract. So.
All right, so here's my yes, and so maybe this is the thing for me is like these are the issues on which game developers who often find themselves facing criticism over business practices that they did not put into play. To some degree, for me, the thing that I would love to see happen is a developer focused restructuring of how. All of this restructuring of the conversation so that things like the Ubisoft, Island of Misfit developers can be framed and talked about as being desirable instead of being, weird. You know, years ago, I wrote a piece with, Waypoint freelancer Ian Williams, about a video, that Blizzard put out that was just a recruitment video. And on first watch, it's like, it was a really tepid, like, simple thing. Like, oh, come work at Blizzard. We have a great company culture. We got good food. You know, I have so much passion for making games. Love to make games. All I wanted to do my whole life is make games. And one of the things that bummed me out was that Blizzard has reportedly really good company culture when it comes to material benefits for workers, has at the time that we were writing anyway, had a good history with keeping developers on, with offering good benefits, with, you know, having the space for people to develop new ideas, to work with people in other departments, and none of that was part of their recruitment effort. None of that was part of why you should go want to work at Blizzard. It all came down to I'm passionate about World of Warcraft. I'm passionate about Diablo. I'm passionate about these brands and about games. And what I want to see happen, and the way for me to get out of the loot box problem, is to start. And I, you know, for me, the end goal is of course going to be about organizing developers eventually, but you don't need to get there on the first, you know, right away. You start by having those conversations and doing that reporting and, you know, if you're in the development community, talking about your interests in a way that's material and about like, hey, the people who get fucked over by bad loot box, you know, situations are the developers who now feel like they're in a less stable position because of fan reaction. The way that you get to saying that like the Ubisoft like development limbo situation actually offers extra job security and a space to again kind of fuck around and figure out what you want to do next and try out new projects. is for developers to be able to talk about that stuff in a way that shows that it's actually beneficial. And for us, you know, on our side, to report on that stuff in a way that's comprehensive and actually kind of situates those things in the context of what, where the industry is at. Like, I don't think we get to get rid of loot boxes. Like, for me, the way you get rid of loot boxes is you have to fundamentally rethink what a budget for a video game is, and like, and think about what those goals look like, and get the business into a place where you're able to make that money back without turning to loot boxes. And
it's funny.
It's
like
a big ask. It's a big ask.
It's interesting to look at a company like Take-Two, because prior to GTA 5 and GTA Online, in which they found like a golden goose to make them money over like several years or like in between. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you go back for like the last like 10 years of Take-Two's fiscal quarters, yep. like their calls, essentially it's them saying like, we didn't make that much money, or we lost money. And then the investors go, when's the next Rockstar game? And they say, well, yep. Rockstar finishes their games when, and like basically Take-Two subsisted on like Rockstar. I mean, you know, games like Bioshock, like some games did okay, but essentially as a company, they were mm-hmm. like, Rockstar was subsidizing everything below them. And like Take-Two's in a much better right. place as a company now than they were a little, you know, like 5 or 6 years ago. But like for a while, like that's essentially how that company operated, in which like one game made so much money that allowed them to try and take risks on other ones in the hopes that they could find like a better balance sheet. But for a while, right. that's basically how Take-Two worked. And I wonder also, video games more than, I can't say this universally, but like much more than a lot of other industries are incredibly opaque about how money is made, how much money is made, right? Like, so, like, you know, the Last Jedi comes out, right? Yeah. I can go look up the box office returns and how much Disney mm-hmm. spent on marketing, or at least there are credible estimates for, like, a lot of those things. And the video game industry has, year after year, in collaboration with, like, outside industry tracking groups, like the NPD group, like, essentially coordinated to hide information about how the industry is doing financially. You combine that with the fact that like Steam essentially took over PC game sales and locked that behind, like you don't get data. Like Steam Spy, that's why Steam Spy is incredible, because it finally unlocks like this enormous black box of really interesting information. And I think if you suddenly the industry tomorrow would like, you know, just open its books so everyone can look at it. I'm not saying that would solve everyone's like trust issues with video game publishers and the incentives they have, but I think like the industry as a whole has systematically created a situation in which it's unclear how money is spent, how much games make, where that money goes. And then
right.
so when you get into a situation where like if the company is saying we need to do games as a service because this is where games are going, games are getting more expensive, and we need to do these things in order to justify making the games that you love. And I think it's reasonable to be deeply suspicious of whether that's true, even if it could be 100% true. Like there it's the conundrum of like the loot box and its implementation of a game instead in which it then destroys the credibility of it, the design of the game holistically. And I think that's also something that happens here, which is people do not have any reason to reasonably trust what they're being told about why right. things are or aren't necessary. Like, go back and look up the quotes about why games had to be increased from $50 to $60 at the advent of the Xbox 360. Where remember, Microsoft, for the first year or like the first 6 months, they didn't go to the $60 price point. They yeah. sold it at $50 saying, well, you know, games are getting more expensive, but there's also like the licensing fees, which is why all these third parties have to, you know, they're going to $60. And they know what Microsoft did? They started charging $60 because yep. why did Sony? Like suddenly they're like, we're not going to charge you for a PlayStation Network. And then PS4 comes along and is like, motherfuckers, we're charging a PlayStation Network. Yep. And I think there's a lot of distrust that is well. Like, look, the internet likes to rage, like, and people are going to get pissed off because they want to get on their high horse, because they want to get likes and, you know, Reddit gold and all that shit. Like, there is always going to be a place for people just wanting to paint someone as the villain because it's a bandwagon, it's popular on the internet. But there's no way that you can't sit here and say the video game industry didn't ask for it in a lot of ways, or at least create, if not ask for it, then create a circumstance in which people are going to take advantage of that and push back in a way that ultimately ends up hurting developers, right? Like, I don't know how Battlefront 2 was made, but is it reasonable to think that a studio that had never put loot boxes into their game before was suddenly said, hey, we have what could be one of the biggest video game of 2017, because let's forget that Battlefront or the PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds came out.
Right. Sure.
You think they said, like, fuck yeah, let's put in loot boxes, because that's going to, like, fundamentally upend our design and, like, probably piss off a lot of people. Like, no, that probably came from maybe that was a compromise decision that was like, hey, we need, you know, budget's got to go this way. But, like, if you're going to if you're not going to charge for a season pass, we need to charge for it another way. And I don't know. It's there. Obviously, there are no easy answers to this, but I also think, as much as like I'm you know, often want to say like I hate it when quote unquote gamers just want to rage on Reddit and other places. Like, there are legitimate grievances with the implementation of a lot of these things, and there are legitimate reasons for people to be inherently distrustful of the lines they are being fed from companies, because it's impossible to know whether when they say we need to do this, do they actually need to do
right that. Which to but me, I think again, goes back to that lack of transparency. Rob, go ahead, sorry.
No, but and I think that's part of why this is in some ways easier to get away with. So when we initially talked about loot boxes, I was a little bit dismissive of the angle that these are actually harmful to people, because I didn't really get it. And I think where that was coming from to an extent was that, you know, I said at the time, my suspicion is the people complaining the loudest, the people who are buying the shit out of these. And what I was thinking when I was saying that was, like, this idea that, like, gamers are often trained to behave like, I think somebody on Twitter, I can't remember who, might have been Metasynth Junkie on Twitter. Is that Naomi?
Yeah, Naomi.
Yeah. Might have said, like, you know, they're trained to be consumer kings. And I think that's part of where this gets a little bit confusing for me personally, is that there are types of players that I think are legitimately vulnerable to these tactics, and these are abusive and exploitative. Like, literally, like, loot boxes are designed to sort of, like, hack human psychology. Like, right. there's no secrecy there. Like, this is really well, this is researched stuff. It's not coming out of nowhere. But at the same time, the backlash against it often smacks of a different form of consumer entitlement to other people's output and other people's labor that you encounter in a lot of spaces around the conversation around games. Mm-hmm. And I think that in some ways makes it very easy to view to view people complaining about it as the enemy, or people who are just trying to get one for free a little bit, particularly right. Because those types of gamers can be so loud that it is very easy to lose all empathy for them entirely, right? Like, to sort of hit that point of, like, fuck it, skin them alive, and just walk away from it. And I think that's an element of this as well, is that it's hard to tune out the legitimate and well-founded concerns around loot boxes and whether or not they're actually doing what publishers are saying they're doing, from just the more generalized brigading that you see.
Right. Well, this is kind of the heart of the frustration for me, is that the people whom I would love the world in which this could become a rallying point for people who disagree about a lot of things, but do want the games industry to be a better, more stable place where people are able to make games that they love without having them compromised, even if that means that we get one less AAA publisher, all said, or even if we get, you know, less games, you know, games take a longer time to develop, or games are shorter. Instead of being, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 hours, they're 10 or 20 or 30 hours. Like, I would like this to be a place where we could find that common ground. And part of what you get at there, Rob, is that the big part of the problem is the people who I would want to be with us here on this are often the same people who have acted as gatekeepers, as misogynists, as racists, who have drawn lines around games and defended them, who have defended companies, who today might say fuck EA for loot boxes and tomorrow might say stop criticizing Valve. And the dilemma for me is how to push that part of that audience into a place where there is a lot more self-reckoning done, that, like, about all of those issues, so that when there are opportunities for the building of coalitions and the addressing of issues that run through the games industry. And again, we just finished recording another podcast where I talked about e-waste and talked about crunch and all that stuff. Like, the way that we as you know, writers and also as consumers can help those issues is to be united and loud about that stuff. But it's so hard to be united with someone who is going to call you fucking slurs on Twitter because you didn't like The Last Jedi as much as they did, or you did like it more than they did, or you, for whatever reason, don't use the tab button to loot in Player Unknown's Battlegrounds, right? Like, and that is where we're at, and it's so fucking hard to understand how, like, I don't know. It's been one of those years where there's been lots of attempted coalition building in politics, and the things that keep that from happening can be very absurd and small and frustrating. But nothing as absurd and small and frustrating as someone saying you don't count as a true gamer because your mouse sensitivity is too low or because you only play games on console. Like, it feels sometimes like there is so much foundational work to be done here. I mean, even the notion of, like, maybe one of the solutions to this is we should start playing games that don't have loot crates in them, full stop. There are a billion good games out this year. Most of them don't deal with this shit at all. And it's frustrating that the new thing that all your friends are playing has these things. But even it's a foundational problem for us that, like, we feel a compulsion to keep up. Partially it's for us as our jobs, but even when it wasn't my job, I wanted to keep up. I wanted to play the new thing. I wanted to do whatever it was. Instead of going on Steam or now Itch or honestly even onto something like the Switch Marketplace, which is filled with decent games that I could support from small developers who are not going to nickel and dime me like this. I don't know. This is me just voicing frustration. This is my turn around the old what is the fucking poll called? I'm so exhausted.
Maypole?
Nope. What's the Seinfeld one?
Oh, the Festivus poll. The Festivus poll. For the airing of grievances.
I'm airing my grievances. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much for picking up that fucking drop ball. So like, that's where I'm at with all of this. And I don't know how to build those coalitions until we get to this common ground of, like, not just having people who are shitty. Maybe the answer is we don't need the people who are shitty. Maybe we can build coalitions without those people.
I think that is the answer.
So yeah, maybe that's what it is.
Because I think in the death throes of neoliberalism, the thing we have learned is that those coalitions are incredibly flimsy and will stop short of making systemic change. And then half your coalition will turn at you at the drop of a dime.
Yep.
I do not think the person who is going to be like, man, no, this, games are a pure meritocracy where it's all about skill and who's the best at the game, and this loot box breaks that trust between me and the developer. I think that person has a 50-50 shot of either getting it or giving a developer a death threat the next time they introduce, like, a story mode to a shooter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. All right. I think on that note, unless someone has some loot box takes. No? Okay.
Yo, if you love looting, Talos 1 space station is full of boxes. What's inside them? Who boxes? Fucking knows? Who knows? Maybe it's ammunition. Maybe it's a shotgun.
Maybe it's trash you could turn into ammunition.
Maybe it's an audio recording of a bunch of space nerds playing D&D.
That game's good. That game's good. It's not going to make my list, but it's good.
You son of a bitch. God, this coalition is over.
I'm building a coalition with Austin.
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick.
Fine. And capitalism are going to go off and
save the world.
Exploit some people. Probably me.
Probably you. Yep.
Go play Doki Doki Literature Club, Rob. Then come back to me.
Also, go play Gorgo. That game's great. All right, let's call it here. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with another one of these. You know where to go. I'm not going to do a whole big thing. Danielle isn't here, so I'm going to say this part. Be good and be good at it.
Horse armor.
Okay. Great. Good. Do it at 50.
Oh, we get to time about this real quick. Yeah. Close that.
I'm not doing it. 50,
you got
then.
Time. You got time. You can do it. You can do it. 49.
All right.
70. Oh, wait. Would you actually do it?
Did we get it?
No, I did it.
I didn't do it. I didn't clap.
Oh. No, Patrick.
You got to have faith, Patrick.
55. All right.
Let's do it. Let's do it at 5 seconds.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.